You're listening to episode 557 of Unwelcome Guests, The Makings of Police State, USA.
HLP versus Holder grew out of challenges to the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which permits the Secretary of State to designate an organization as a foreign terrorist organization. ADPA, which it's called, also criminalizes knowingly providing material support or resources to a foreign terrorist organization, including nonviolent activities of the organization. The challenge to the law claimed that it was unconstitutionally vague and that the Humanitarian Law Project sued because of its intent to provide advice and training to the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK, on nonviolent dispute resolution techniques. The Supreme Court found such activity a violation of the law and that even advice to these organizations is illegal and not a violation of the First Amendment. The decision was rendered in June of 2010. By September of 2010, the Joint Anti-Terrorism Task Force in Chicago sent FBI agents to search the homes of activists in Minneapolis and Chicago, most of whom are associated with a particular political party and most of whom were active against the RNC in 2008. The agents took computers and many other pieces of personal property. Subpoenas to over 20 others to appear before a grand jury have been issued, and so far not one of the people subpoenaed has been willing to cooperate with the grand jury. Similarly, activists in many cities are being visited by the FBI and being rebuffed. The National Lawyers Guild has a Know Your Rights handbook, and advice is available through the NLG. It appears that one of the people who is being targeted had been at a peace conference in Colombia in the year 2000, where representatives of all the parties to the civil unrest, including the FARC, were present. Somehow, her attendance at this meeting is being considered giving material support to the FARC, which is named as a foreign terrorist organization. Similarly, another person is being targeted who is a leader of the Palestinian community. And while I do not know what he is being targeted for, he has traveled to Palestine and has probably met people on other listed foreign terrorist organizations. So far, there have been no indictments, but this case and this law are particularly troubling for people who engage in international solidarity work. As president of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, I travel the world meeting with colleagues who are struggling for peace and justice. Members of the National Lawyers Guild are also involved in significant international solidarity work. EDPA and the ruling in Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project are extremely troubling because we cannot fail to support people who are fighting for their rights around the world. The last issue I want to raise is the case of WikiLeaks and the treatment of Bradley Manning and the possible indictment of Julian Assange. I'm a firm believer in transparency in government, and I believe that revealing information which exposes possible war crimes or illegal actions being covered up in diplomatic cables is not espionage. Information and documents may embarrass the U.S., but many of the documents so far leaked do not relate to our national defense and are not designed to injure the U.S. or advantage a foreign nation, as is required by the espionage before it is considered illegal. Although others disagree, the current grand jury has been impaneled to investigate those supporters of Bradley Manning, and that must be opposed, as well as the treatment of the torture that he is suffering. Indeed, yesterday, David House, a leader of Bradley Manning's support committee, refused to testify to the grand jury in Alexandria, Virginia. The relevance of the Rosenberg case today can be seen in an unbroken line of attempts to use laws of questionable constitutionality and breadth to chill the work of progressive activists and build a strong progressive movement. The McCarthy era and the fear that it engendered weakened the labor movement, as liberals in the labor movement and elsewhere had to buy into a Cold War mentality and, like Judge Frank, found themselves prisoners of the system that they served. The weakness in the labor movement has caused some of the major structural inequalities that have led to and perpetuate the current economic crisis, and which has led to the rise of right-wing and corporatist parties who called everything that is vaguely progressive socialist. In addition to demonizing socialists, the right promotes a climate of fear of terrorism and gets apoplectic when leaders have tried to classify terrorists as engaging in criminal acts which must be investigated as any criminal case, and not as an international terrorist conspiracy, which must be the subject of perpetual war. We are told that there are secret sleeper cells of terrorists who are plotting to harm us every day. It is used to justify the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the use of drones in Pakistan and Yemen, and the armed intervention in Libya. We must seek lessons from the past and not allow the repressive apparatus that now characterizes the national security state to deter our efforts to promote peace and justice. Only through speaking out and fighting back can we avoid becoming prisoners of the system ourselves. Thank you very much.
Well, of course, I appreciate that emphasis on what is just, a question which too often is substituted in people's minds by the much less important one, in my opinion, what is legal. We're now going to hear most of the recordings of an event which took place on the 31st of May in DePaul University, Chicago. The American Friends Service Committee organized a meeting entitled "Then They Came for Me, Civil Liberties in Peril in Chicago."
On behalf of the American Friends Service Committee and all the co-sponsoring organizations tonight, I want to welcome you all. Thanks for being here. My name is Michael McConnell. I'm the regional director of AFSC. As you might know, it was founded in 1917. It's a Quaker organization, founded first to support conscientious objectors to World War I. We're a peace and social justice organization espousing pacifism and nonviolence. That'll be relevant in a moment as I talk a bit about AFSC's own history with the FBI. So we're here tonight because on September 24th, 2010, the FBI carried out a series of raids in Chicago and Minneapolis. Following the raids, the Justice Department subpoenaed 23 Palestinian and Colombian solidarity activists to appear before a Chicago grand jury headed by U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald. A grand jury is a secret court. It's a secret court proceeding where the jury members are not screened for bias, where a prosecutor questions witnesses without a defense attorney present, and where there is no judge and the witnesses have no right to refuse to testify. The title for tonight's event is taken from Martin Niemöller, a German pastor during the Nazi era. First they came for the communists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and they didn't speak out. I was a Protestant. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. The words, "then they came for me," are particularly relevant to Stephanie Weiner tonight. Stephanie teaches English in Chicago City Colleges, is a founder of AFSCME Local 3506, and is one of the activists whose house was raided, and she and her husband were subpoenaed. "They came for me" is also very poignant and relevant for Sarah Smith, who's a college student who participated in a delegation to Palestine and Israel, and shortly thereafter was subpoenaed by the FBI. "Then they came for the trade unionists," very important and relevant, poignant words for Leah Fried, who's been an organizer with the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America for 13 years. Also on the panel this evening is Rima Ahmad, Executive Director of Project Mobilize, a political action nonprofit organization dedicated to the advancement of politically marginalized communities at the local, national, and state levels. I'll wait for a minute to introduce Michael Deutsch. But the words, "and I didn't speak out," are relevant for the rest of us here tonight. By the end of the event tonight, I hope that those words will not be followed by any of us. We will not only learn tonight better the role of the FBI and the abuse of grand juries in the United States, but also we need to learn about what unity and solidarity and sticking together and speaking up mean for all of us. So I want to provide a brief historical context before we get into the other speakers. We could start back probably in the 1700s, but we'll start with the Espionage Act of 1917. Think of World War I. The country is a bit hysterical about Germany, about the Russian Revolution. And so the Espionage Act of 1917 was passed, which ostensibly was aimed at treason during World War I, but was so far-reaching that it included obstructing enlistment and recruiting for the war effort. Eugene Debs was arrested as a peace activist under this act. And if you think it's irrelevant for today, then you could read the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by Dianne Feinstein, who wanted to prosecute Julian Assange, founder of WikiLeaks, under this Espionage Act. The Sedition Act of 1918, up to 20 years in prison to utter, write, publish any disloyal language against the U.S. government. And the Alien Act, barring foreign-born anarchists from the United States. It seemed that at that time, as today, those who speak a different language are suspect and raises hysterical kinds of feelings in many of the population. Okay, in the Patriot Act, if you think of the Patriot Act today, just as those acts were passed in the light of World War II, we have the Patriot Act passed in light of 9/11. Far-reaching powers to put under surveillance all of us. Well, those acts were actually put operational by A. Mitchell Palmer, the Attorney General, in 1920 as they raided all across the country. 4,000 people were arrested in 23 different states. And it formed the Bureau of Investigation, which had over 200,000 cards on political activists, like many of us in this room. And that whole system was devised and put under the control of a guy named J. Edgar Hoover. I have here just one page from 1921. This is a page of the FBI files of the American Friends Service Committee. We were 4 years old at the time, and we have our first FBI file. Through FOIA, we found out we had thousands of pages up until 1970 on AFSC, again, a nonviolent pacifist organization by Quakers. So let's jump ahead to COINTELPRO. Many of the people here know COINTELPRO, but a lot of people in the general public have never heard of it. It lasted from 1956 to 1971. It involved surveillance, infiltration, discrediting and disrupting of domestic political organizations. And the historical record shows that it infiltrated and acted against the civil rights movement, blocking electoral legal politics, undermining universities and cultural groups, disrupting political activities, which were disapproved of by the FBI. And it involved provocateurs, arson, bombings, break-ins, undercover agents, infiltrating First Amendment groups and events, and finally murder, as in the case of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, most notably here in Chicago. I want to just read a few words from the Church report. Frank Church was head of the Senate Investigating Committee that looked into COINTELPRO. See if any of these ring similar, familiar. From the Church report, many of the techniques used would be intolerable in a democratic society, even if all the targets had been involved in violent activity. But COINTELPRO went far beyond that. The Bureau conducted a sophisticated vigilante operation aimed at squarely preventing the exercise of First Amendment rights. Many of the targets were nonviolent. They adopted tactics unworthy of a democracy, reminiscent of a totalitarian regime, expanded beyond their initial scope, and government officials, whose duty it was to enforce the law, have violated or ignored the law and then defended their right to break the law. That was all the Church Committee's words about COINTELPRO. The methods that were used, as I said, infiltration, political, psychological warfare from the outside. There were a number of dirty tricks, fake letters, anonymous phone calls to try to disrupt groups and try to break trust. Harassment through the legal system, which was the grand jury system, and extra legal force and violence, including assaults, beatings, and assassinations, in order to disrupt the movement. So there is precedent for the FBI and the U.S. government to go after legitimate First Amendment activities, to disrupt and discredit them, and to create a situation of distrust among all of people like us. All kinds of groups have been under this kind of disruption. And in Chicago, the Chicago Red Squad, we had a particular form of this. Such subversive groups as the United Methodist Church, the League of Women Voters, the PTA, and the American Friends Service Committee. And we had a bug underneath our conference table during that period in the late 60s and early 70s. The jury, when all of this came to light, the Red Squad, the jury said, the evidence has clearly shown that the security section of the Chicago Police Department assaulted the fundamental freedoms of speech, association, press, and religion, as well as the constitutional right to privacy of hundreds of individuals. And the FBI is obviously is still at it, but we also have other groups like the Thomas Merton Center, the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Greenpeace, the Catholic Worker, and other Quaker groups that have been spied on by the FBI from 2001 to 2007. And farther back, the American Indian Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, CISPAS, Solidarity with people of El Salvador, all were targets of the FBI. Finally, just let me say a brief history about, the expert is sitting next to me, so, and this is from some of his writings. The grand jury system was actually started in 17th century England. It was originally designed maybe to protect the individual rights of people, but has been used for the last three centuries to undermine those rights. And in the U.S., the grand jury system has undermined the rights of abolitionists, Reconstruction and black suffragists, trade unionists organizing for the eight-hour day, strikers, and anti-war activists. During the McCarthy era, the investigative grand jury came into existence, and it became a rubber stamp for prosecution approvals. In 1950, Congress passed the Internal Security Act, which in essence included an emergency detention provision granting the legal authority for mass roundups of dissidents and their indefinite detention. And in 1954, Congress passed a special immunity act which applied only to matters of internal security and gave what was called transactional immunity. In other words, you couldn't invoke your Fifth Amendment rights of silence before the grand juries, which is particularly relevant for all of us here today. So that's a brief history. I want to introduce Michael Deutsch. He has worked for 40 years to support and defend civil rights and the People's Law Office here in Chicago. I'm imagining that if someone wrote a novel a la To Kill a Mockingbird and it was made into a movie, the Michael Deutsch figure would be like Atticus Finch, for he is, I hope, a name. When we hear the word civil liberties, I hope Michael Deutsch is one of the first names you think of after hearing civil liberties. So, Michael.
The events of the last months, targeting activists in international solidarity movement, members of the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, and particularly people who are involved in the support for the rights of the Palestinian people is really part of a pattern of practice and policies that the U.S. government and particularly the Justice Department and the FBI have carried out for the last 50 to 60 years. So this is a continuation of repression against people on the left, socialists, people who are progressive. And the attacks usually always begin, or in many cases begin, with the infiltration of an activist group by an agent provocateur. Sometimes they're informants who are working with the police. Sometimes they're actually members of the police. And oftentimes these informants try to provoke people to get involved in what they believe is criminal activity, try to encourage criminal activity, and oftentimes are all reporting to the police continually about the work of the people who are involved. And of course, we know of cases, the Black Panther Party was infiltrated by FBI agents, the American Indian Movement was infiltrated, and there's a consistent policy of infiltrating organizations. In this case, with these people who have been targeted, there was a police agent that originally was placed in Minnesota who was involved in spying on the efforts to protest the Republican National Convention. After the convention was over, that informant, that police agent, stayed on and infiltrated the Freedom Socialist Organization. And from we know at least one informant, there could have been more, and we know that they have actually, this informant was provocateur, was trying to get people to do what she believed to be criminal activity, and despite the revelations of the Church Commission that this went on in the 60s, under the Patriot Act, this can still happen. You can infiltrate organizations even though they're not involved in criminal activity, and it's happened in this case. And then what happens oftentimes is once the informant is placed there and is providing information, the information that the informant provides to the government, to the FBI, much of it is exaggerated or not even true. They take that information and they put it in a search warrant, an affidavit for a search warrant, which they give to a judge, and they tell the judge, well, this is what this organization is doing, or this is what these people are saying. And the judge then accepts the word of the FBI based on the informant and issues a search warrant and allows the FBI to go and raid the homes of the people. And as we know, on September 23rd, many of the homes of people were raided. Hundreds of documents were taken, First Amendment documents, people's computers, their cell phones, their political documents, stuff protected by the First Amendment, were all taken. Thousands of documents were taken in coordinated raids. So they used the informant to infiltrate the group. Then they get the informant to provide information for an affidavit for a search warrant to justify the searches. Then, usually following the searches, or even independent of searches, they will convene a grand jury to try to force people to provide information about what they're investigating. And as Michael said, there's a long history of the grand jury being used against political activists. What's happened since the late 60s is the right to remain silent. If you're called before a grand jury, you have a Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. If the FBI comes to your door, you don't have to talk to the FBI. You have a right to remain silent. But what the courts have said is that if you're given what's called immunity, which means now that originally the immunity was transactional immunity, which means that if you testify, for example, about a bank robbery, they can never charge you with the bank robbery. The court has now limited that immunity to what's called use immunity, which means what you say in front of the grand jury cannot be used against you. Once they give you that immunity, you have to testify. That immunity takes away your Fifth Amendment right. So even though the information you say can't be used against you, they can still charge you with crimes by independent information, but more importantly, they want to turn you into an informant against your movement. So they want to ask you questions about your political associations, your political beliefs, your neighbors, where you travel. All these things are open questions before the grand jury. And of course, as Michael said, you go into the grand jury without a lawyer. A lawyer can't go in with you. There's no judge in the grand jury. It's just the prosecutor and 23 people who are basically rubber stamps of the prosecutor. It's been said that a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich if the if the prosecutor wanted them to. So they used the grand jury to investigate more information against political movements and to intimidate people, because if you're given immunity and you don't testify, you can go to jail for contempt. And there's two types of contempt. There's civil contempt, which is measured by the life of the grand jury, which is usually 18 months, or there's what's called criminal contempt, which can be up to life in prison. And I recently represented a Palestinian man who refused to be an informant against this movement, refused to testify in the grand jury, and he was given 11 years in prison for refusing to testify. That act of civil disobedience, he was given 11 years in prison. So once they did the raids, first they put the informant in there, then they did the raids, then they gathered all this information, then they issued these subpoenas, first 14 subpoenas for people who are active in the anti-war movement and active in solidarity work for Palestine and Colombia. And then after those 14, there was another 9 people subpoenaed to the grand jury. So 23 people were subpoenaed to the grand jury in this case. But the great thing was that people refused to voluntarily cooperate with that grand jury investigation. Every single person said they are not going to voluntarily go in there and give information to that grand jury. And that solidarity and the organizing around that resistance, which has been built up for 40 years by different movements, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the Black Liberation Movement, the Women's Movement, the Catholic Left Movement, have all taken a position of that kind. Many people have gone to jail, but it's a position of anti-collaboration. We will not collaborate with an arm of the FBI and the arm of the U.S. Attorney's Office who is trying to repress political movements. But because those 23 people stood in solidarity, and because people organized, they have not at this point moved to force people to testify under threat of contempt. And I believe it's because they know that these people will not cooperate, and by putting these people in jail, they're going to create martyrs and people will be able to rally around them. So the resistance to the grand jury in this case has been quite significant. It's been unified. It's been political. And it's one of the reasons why no one has been forced to testify or go to jail. So you have the informant, you have the FBI raids, you have the use of the grand jury, and then the final piece in this act of repression is the return of indictment. And usually the indictments are conspiracy indictments, which means that you don't have to prove anyone actually took any specific act. You just have to prove an agreement. There's seditious conspiracy, which was used against the Puerto Rican independence movement, which basically says conspiracy to oppose the authority of the U.S. government in Puerto Rico. There's what's called a RICO conspiracy, which is a racketeering, influence, corrupt organization conspiracy, in which the government accuses a group of being a criminal enterprise and then says that the members of the group are part of a conspiracy to violate the law. And that's been used against political activists, Palestinian activists, Black Liberation activists. There's a conspiracy to violate the Animal Enterprise Act that's been used, conspiracy against animal rights activists. And there's the general conspiracy law, which makes it a crime to agree to only, it's an inchoate offense, agree to only commit a crime, even if no one actually takes a step to commit a crime. In this case, what we are looking at is the probability, if there are indictments, and we think there most likely will be indictments, that they're going to be brought under what's called the conspiracy to provide material support for a foreign terrorist organization. Now, what does that mean? The Secretary of State was given the power back in 1996 to designate foreign organizations as terrorist organizations. There's no open hearing about it. There's no right to be heard in opposition to it. The Secretary of State can rely on hearsay, newspaper articles, secret testimony, and they make a list of organizations which they believe are terrorist organizations. Four of the five main Palestinian organizations are on that list. There are groups from Colombia, from Nepal, all over the world, and mostly there are groups that the U.S., they oppose U.S. foreign policy, and the U.S. is involved in supporting the governments that these organizations are involved with. The law says that if you provide material support for such an organization, that that's a crime. And material support under the language of the law can be training, can be service, can be supporting the issues and causes of that organization, can be providing money for that organization. So the law is very broad, and what happened is in June of this year, the Supreme Court interpreted that law to say that First Amendment activity, demonstrations, writing articles, explaining to people about this organization can be criminal acts and provide material support. So for example, if you write an op-ed piece that's about an organization that's on that list, that could be considered providing material support. And what the court said was that any act which is in coordination with or under the direction of one of these organizations, you can be charged with providing material support and be in prison for up to 15 years. Now, I'm not talking about providing weapons or providing safe houses, or providing anything that has anything to do with violence, and not even necessarily providing money directly to these organizations. What I'm talking about is supporting the political ideas of these organizations. If the government believes that you're doing it in coordination or under the direction of one of these organizations that's on the list, you can be charged and convicted of providing material support. And the other thing that's so insidious about this law is that the government claims that many of these organizations work through front groups, which means groups that are on the ground, non-governmental organizations, particularly in the Middle East. You have many non-governmental organizations who are doing work serving the needs of the people. Well, the government says that these groups, many of these groups, are front groups for these designated foreign terrorist organizations. So that if you are working with a group that's providing an orphanage or a hospital and has nothing directly to do with one of these groups, but the government claims that they're a front group for that organization, that can be considered material support for a terrorist group. If you're charged with this type of indictment, you cannot go into court and challenge whether the group is really, in fact, a terrorist group. Once the Secretary of State puts them on the list, they're on that list, and it's not an issue for a jury to decide. The only issue is to decide is whether you knowingly provided material support. Jimmy Carter, who went and helped Hezbollah with the elections in Lebanon and worked with them, would be providing material support for a designated terrorist organization. The Los Angeles Times, which published op-ed article from the leader of Hamas, would be providing material support for a terrorist organization. Now, we know Jimmy Carter and the LA Times is not going to be charged under this statute, but the breadth of this statute, a lawyer filing an amicus brief challenging whether Hamas or any other group is a terrorist group, could be providing material support for that group. A demonstration about in support of a group or a political prisoner of a group that's on that list. The leader of the PFLP, for example, is in prison in Israel. If you are active in supporting the freedom of that leader, and you are writing articles in support of that, you could be charged with providing material support. So material support for terrorism, it's very important. It's not about bombs and guns and safe houses. It's about First Amendment activity. And in fact, The case that was decided in June in the Supreme Court was called Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project. The reason it's called Holder is because it was brought by the Obama administration by Eric Holder, who was the Attorney General. The lower court had found that it would be a violation of the First Amendment to criminalize First Amendment activity under the material support law. The Obama administration decided to appeal that decision to the Supreme Court. The plaintiffs in that case were human rights activists who were trying to teach the Kurdish movement how to file human rights complaints at the United Nations. And they brought a case saying, can we do this? It wasn't a criminal case, it was a civil case. Can we advise them how to file human rights violations in the United Nations? Can we teach them how to negotiate peace agreements? And the Supreme Court said, if you're working with that group under their direction or under their control, whether you're just advising them how to provide human rights complaints or how to get peace agreements, you can be prosecuted under the law. So that's the situation. They brought the case to the Supreme Court, and we have, as you know, a very reactionary Supreme Court. Just today, the Supreme Court said you couldn't sue Attorney General Ashcroft using the material witness law. Now, they were locking people up after 9/11 saying they were material witnesses without charging them with crimes using like a law of preventive detention. And they locked up hundreds of people, not charging with crimes, saying they were potential witnesses and they were going to flee, so they locked them up. And again, the lower court in California said that was against the law. That's using preventive detention. The material witness law was never for that. The Obama administration appealed that decision, and today the Supreme Court said, oh, that's okay, they can do that. You can't sue Ashcroft for that kind of activity. So we have a situation where people may think we have a new administration here who is changing the direction of civil liberties and civil rights, but in fact they are institutionalizing what Bush began, because now there's no outcry from the Democrats about it. They're going along with it. So now the rendition, sending people to other countries to be tortured, preventive detaining people, using this material law, using this material support law, all been used and approved by the Obama administration. And when they lose a case in the lower court, they bring it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reverses the lower court. So we're now looking at a situation where we have 23 people who are under the threat of being held in contempt. Because of the support of you and other people, they have not moved on them. But I can assure you that the grand jury is hard at work, the FBI is hard at work, the U.S. attorney is working, and there will be most likely indictments under the material support for a foreign terrorist organization. And when they bring these indictments, we're going to need your support. We're going to need your support in the courtroom. We're going to need you to line up every day to come to court. We're going to need your public support, condemning it in the newspapers, in the area of public opinion. We're going to need your resources to support the legal defense. And we're going to need your outrage, because what has happened here is outrageous. They are criminalizing people who are not even close to being involved in terrorist activity. Nothing they've done other than speak out, organize, demonstrate, write articles, put out a newspaper, has nothing to do with terrorism. But what they're doing is trying to silence people who are trying to educate the American people about what's going on in the Middle East and Colombia. They don't want people to know how the Palestinian people are being treated and rights are being denied. One of the people that I've been representing, Hatem Abadeya, who can't be here tonight because his mother is ill, is the executive director of the AAAN, Arab American Action Network. And he is one of the main people they've targeted. His house was raided, all his books were taken, all his personal property was taken. They also wanted documents from his organization. He's been subpoenaed to a grand jury, and he is one of the main people they're trying to silence because of his activity and his and the work he's done in here in Chicago and throughout the United States. He and other people here need your support and need you to stand up and say no. Regardless of what the administration is going to do, we need people who are going to fight for the rights of these people. Thank you.
Now, the full Q&A is available from this show's website, but I've picked out the following few minutes as a highlight.
On September 24th at 7 o'clock in the morning, our house was raided. And so, of course, we tried to call lawyers. We couldn't find any of the lawyers that we knew so well. And the reason is most of them that we knew were at the National Lawyers Guild convention in New Orleans. And on the agenda for that day, that Friday, September 24th, was a workshop to talk about what are we going to do about this terrible law that had just turned around in June, just a few months earlier. So that's why the National Lawyers Guild was able to make a statement within hours, because they had a workshop all set up already. They knew there was a storm coming down the hill. And by the way, just about that law, to remind you, in all the lower courts, it was ruled that that was perfectly legal and acceptable behavior. It was only, I'm not a lawyer, but it was only, as I understand, as it got to the higher levels that the thing turned itself around. So it's a sign of the hypocrisy, but also the political nature of how the wind turns. And
thank you for the wonderful talk. I had two quick questions. The first was, and something I've been sort of like thinking about and sort of talking about for a while, like, why now? You know, like why now this giant concerted effort to sort of attack activists, you know? And like, is it tied to sort of the normal dissent that sort of like is usually squelched in like economic crisis? And like we see that in the academy too. Is it a response to like maybe the U.S. powers losing maybe the war of ideas with the sort of flotilla stuff and sort of Operation Cast Lead, in which like now sort of these options are sort of seen as sort of like, you know, not quite so damaging. Maybe the U.S. isn't on the side of good. And sort of like, you know, what is going on? Like, why now do these attacks come? Like, something I'm very curious with. And the second question is, just sort of from your experience, like, so, like, what sort of things can organizations do to sort of, like, keep security and sort of, like, to sort of, like, you know, sort of prevent some of these things without not being on, like, defense footing and sort of, like, losing and, like, sort of, like, being paranoid and sort of stuff like that? Thank you.
Okay, obviously, we don't know what's in the mind of the powers that be, so we can only speculate. I think there's several factors. One is the Holder case kind of gives a green light now to go after people who are public activists, First Amendment people who support the struggles in Palestine and Colombia and other places. It tells the government that you can prosecute these people even though they're involved in First Amendment activities. That's one thing. I also think that the struggle for ideas is one in which the government wants to suppress the truth about what's going on in the Middle East and Colombia and other places, but particularly in Palestine. And I think that the work that people have done with delegations and speakers and events has begun to educate people about what's going on in Palestine and the rights of the Palestinian people. I tried a case in 2006 in the federal court here, which my client was accused falsely of being a leader, a military leader of Hamas. He was a grocer from Bridgeport and was arrested in Israel and tortured for 58 days and gave a confession. And they brought the secret police from Israel to testify against him. We had a trial in front of a jury of people from Chicago and Northern District of Illinois, African-American, white people. And him and his co-defendant were acquitted of these charges. They were convicted of minor charges, but acquitted of the major charge, even though there was a confession because the jury rejected it. And our case, and any case about that charges activists who are involved in the Palestinian struggle, is about educating people about what the real issues are and what the real human rights violations are being perpetrated against the Palestinian people. When you do that, you can get people on your side. You can get them on your side in a courtroom, and you can get them on your side in the public opinion. So I think they want to silence that, and they don't want people organizing in support of that. And that's one of the other reasons. The third reason is they have an informant, and they want to use that informant before that informant's no longer viable. And therefore, the informant tells them a bunch of stuff, mostly which is exaggerated and not true, and then they feel like either that informant is gone or they have to use that informant. So that those factors are all at play, in my opinion.
I was just going to add that this isn't a vote. For all the people that talk about the 10 factors, I think all of them can be in play. I certainly agree with all the ones he said. For example, to give a little bit of the calendar, the grand jury that we're talking about, when they came to our door on September 24th, actually began, was convened in August of 2009. So that's not, you know, the BDS movement wasn't really on the insurgency in 2009, not really in the same way. And a lot of this started because the informant was sent because of the RNC, the Republican National Convention, which was in September of 2008. And for people who weren't at that demonstration, but were at 100 other kinds, I don't think you really understand that the Republican National Convention was an enormous demonstration of national scope. The people of Minnesota would not allow the Republican Convention to become another battle in Seattle. $50 million was spent to ensure that the security would be there in place. Enormous infrastructure of security guards, new equipment. I'm not sure, but I think the FBI office in Minnesota is one of the largest in all of America, and it's perhaps related to that RNC demonstration. People that you mentioned from the RNC 8, they were arrested before the demonstration on the charges of what they would have done had they not been arrested, you know? So it was very, very high security, and the millions of dollars of insurance that were spent. So that was 2008. And to say something else, in the new FBI documents that were just released a week ago, it says that the original spark in the eye that caught their attention was a delegation that went to Colombia, I believe, in 2002 or 2003. It's not to say that the Palestine isn't clearly one of their new morphs and targets, but it just shows you these are years and years of things going on. Part of it's money, by the way. Since I mentioned money of the RNC, there's a lot of FBI agents that got to look like they're doing something, you know, next to the soft serve machine. And so part of it is just the FBI looking like they do things. Part of it is the military complex wanting to make more planes and bombs to go to more countries. And fear, apparently, is part of what they use.
Now, the question why are governments now turning the screws on activists really deserves a show in itself, but I think first point to note is it's not just in the US, it's around the world. So recently in the UK, people have been arrested because of plans they had, completely illegal, but reflecting the mentality, which is we are determined to keep control of you by whatever means we physically can, never mind any ideas about social consensus or justice. I think this represents increasing short-termism and desperation as the hierarchical control model is realizing that its goose is cooked. Even without mass movement of people rising up because they can see what is going on, the world, in terms of resources, ain't going to take it, and the system will collapse under its own ecological weight. Now, of course, the more people who are aware of this and make alternative arrangements, the better, which is perhaps the main reason that I'm making this show. Now, I thought I'd give the last word to Leah Fried, a union organizer who references the McCarthyist terror with which we began the show.
So my name's Leah Freed. I'm an organizer with the UE, and I'm very happy to be here to talk a little bit about labor support for the 23 activists and what labor can do and why labor should condemn these attacks. My union, UE, I can speak to UE in a minute, but what I do know is that many, many local unions, many labor councils, and regional bodies of unions, and I think UE has been the first national union, have all come out and condemned the attacks, and as organizations have committed to fighting this injustice. So that's great news. My union, UE, specifically took this step for two reasons, and both of them are very personal to our organization. The first is that Stephanie and her husband, Joe Eisenbaker, are good friends to our organization, and some of you may have remembered the occupation of the UE worker occupation of Republic Windows and Doors. And I think Stephanie and Joe were there every day fighting, speaking out, doing great solidarity. And they also did wonderful solidarity when another factory was closing and workers were getting screwed by Wells Fargo this time, not getting paid their vacations. And they actually turned out people to the Quad City area. And we had planned a protest there. We had planned to block the road and do civil disobedience, sit in the middle of the road to demonstrate that Wells Fargo was a roadblock to our economic recovery, and because they were refusing to sell the business to several interested buyers and keep the place open. And so Joe and Stephanie and their fight back folks and labor union members from several states, at least three states, all turned out to this small town, Rock Island, for this protest in solidarity with the workers. And we showed up, and I had called the chief of police of Rock Island beforehand and said, look, this is what we're going to do. It's peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience. And I showed up, and every single Rock Island cop was there. And I said, what's going on? Why this major police force? And they said the FBI contacted us and told us that some very dangerous people were going to be present, and we needed to make sure we had every cop on the beat there. So they literally had every single police officer pulled in, paid all kinds of overtime, because Stephanie is so dangerous, right? This is ridiculous. But, you know, they showed us tremendous solidarity, and so it's the least that UE can do to stand with them and condemn the attacks on them and do whatever we can to support them. It was noted, I think it was 10 out of the first 14 are union members, and I don't know about the other nine, probably a good number of them as well. And so these are our people that are being attacked in more ways than one. But UE also personally lived through this type of repression. And I'm just going to read a statement, a part of the statement from the General Executive Board of our national union that came out to condemn these attacks. And it says, during the Red Scare of the late 40s and 50s, the combined forces of the corporations, the federal government, both major political parties, the media, and opportunistic business unions nearly succeeded in destroying UE and crushing progressive trade unionism. Because of the persecution that our union suffered and barely survived in that era, we in UE have a continuing obligation to speak out forcefully whenever civil liberties are endangered by political hysteria and repression. And so it ends saying, we call on President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder to immediately halt these grand jury proceedings, to order FBI and Justice Department personnel to return all property improperly seized in last September's FBI raids on peace activists. And it goes on from there. But I want to touch upon that historical moment, because it really shows how serious these attacks are and how they have really transformed our history in this country and how the labor movement was severely affected by that. Many of you may know some of this history, so forgive me if I repeat things you already know, but you know, UE was founded in 1936, along with many other unions. We were founding members of the Congress of, well, at that time it was the Committee of Industrial Unions, and it was a new type of unionism where hundreds of thousands of workers were organized in major factories and other workplaces, and really was the burgeoning of a social justice type of movement. And it was common for unions in that era to have very outspoken and mobilize around U.S. foreign policy, domestic issues, things beyond the workplace, because workers live in a society and in a world, and that was important. And, you know, there was mass organizing taking place, and it sort of culminated after World War II when there had been a freeze on pay and benefits during the wartime. In 1946, several unions, including UE, the UAW, the steelworkers, struck for improvements in major industry and won. This was a coordinated strike that took place. And in that year, over 5 million workers struck for improvements in their workplace, better pay, benefits, and better rights. Not an accident, then, that the following year, in 1947, Taft-Hartley was passed. How many people here know what the Taft-Hartley Law is? A couple people. This is a law that outlaws jurisdictional strikes, political strikes, secondary boycotts, and it ushered in the right-to-work laws, which forces unions to provide representation without pay, without any sort of compensation for that. But one of the worst aspects of this law, if there is one, was the requirement that union officers sign non-communist affidavits. And if you refused to do so, you were banned from protection under the NLRB, and you couldn't participate in National Labor Board conducted elections. And so at first, there was a universal opposition to this. And unions said, we're not signing it. You know, go to hell. You can't tell us who our leaders are. And we're not going to sign these affidavits. And then slowly, unions began to succumb to the pressure, began to purge leaders who had any sort of communist or socialist affiliation, and then began to raid each other. Specifically, UE was one of the unions that was went after. The same union, you know, UAW, who we were on the picket line with, not a few years before, then began to raid UE and try and steal members out of UE, and UE had no defense because we were barred from participating in the National Labor Relations Board process. What they successfully did was divided and conquered what was a very progressive labor movement, and what was ushered in, to make a long story short, was a much more business unionism model, which is a model that focuses strictly on sort of bread and butter issues, and frankly not that well, and does not necessarily look at larger societal issues, human rights, economic justice as a whole. And as you know, most of you, the labor movement since then has really been in a serious decline. My time is up, but I have so much more to say. What I can say is, I don't want to end by saying the labor movement's in decline, but what I do want to say is, you know, there has been a serious revival of social justice unionism in this country, and that's really heartening. And as I mentioned in the statement, you know, we survived that horrible time period despite the House of Un-American Activity Committee and the McCarthy Subcommittee on Investigations. They used these investigations specifically timed so that when UE was facing a challenge in a workplace, they would subpoena UE leaders and then we would lose an election in the workplace. They would time it in order to prevent us from mobilizing around some major issue. There were attempts to revoke the naturalized citizenship of our director of organization, Jim Mattless, who was a great union leader and contributed so much to humanity. So, you know, the labor movement did manage to heal from that, but it really fundamentally changed workers' power in this country. And so we need to take these kind of attacks very seriously and look at them in a historical context and see what they have the power to do and stand together and stop them.
I hope this show has helped you to understand the agendas of people who would make you afraid and given you courage to resist. This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.